Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. One feminist anthropologist has proposed that the degree of equality of men and women in a society can be measured by the likelihood that a woman achieves an orgasm during lovemaking. The more patriarchal and sexually repressive the culture, the less likely she is to orgasm. In more equal societies, men will be more attuned to women's needs and sexual satisfaction. You see, the problem is that men and women are basically sexually incompatible. Men can reach orgasm and then be back in front of the TV before most women have even begun to get warmed up. Biologist Martha McClintock's research suggests that this difference in sexual response times may have been evolutionarily functional for our mammal forebears. McClintock's experiments show that in the wild, groups of female rats all enter fertility around the same time and then have sex with all the males in their troop at about the same time, slowly working their way up to their orgasm through a series of studs. This means that the males spread their seed widely, while the females and their offspring benefit from serious ambiguity about the parentage of the baby rats. Sadly, times have changed, and most sex occurs today among humans in dyadic pairs, and many men aren't skilled or knowledgeable enough to bring their partners off reliably, certainly not with purely penile insertion and vaginal stimulation. Freud argued that clitoral orgasm was less mature than vaginal orgasm. Then in 1976, Sherry Haidt published the Haidt Report, based on 3,000 questionnaires of women about their sexual happiness. She reported that a very small percentage of all the women who had responded to her survey achieved orgasm through intercourse alone. Generally, they required some form of clitoral stimulation. She also uncovered an enormous reservoir of unhappiness among women about their sexual lives. She is author, most recently, of Sex and Business, The New Haidt Report, a follow-up to her study from the 1970s, the autobiographical Haidt Report on Haidt, and the Haidt Report on the Family, Growing Up Under Patriarchy. Dr. Haidt, you're an American expatriate living in France and Britain for the last 15 years. Hasn't the ascendance of George Bush's compassionate conservatism lured you back to the homestead yet?
I was told the other day that the two daughters, the twins, like my books.
Well, that's good.
Which was a great shock to me. And anyway, I wondered if this was the influence of their mother or something, because I doubt that Mr. Bush knows much about them. And he didn't send me a personal invitation to come back.
Right. Now, you left the United States 15 years ago because you felt that you were under pressure from right-wing Christian attacks on your work.
Well, they were more the attacks on my body. I mean, the same groups who go after the abortion clinic doctors probably have some feminists on their list as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I got some really violent... I really felt my life wasn't safe.
And that was because of the nature of your critiques of patriarchy and your calls for more sexual openness.
I think that they didn't, well, Patrick Buchanan said in his speech endorsing George Bush at one point for the Democratic nomination, or sorry, the Republican nomination, that now that communism is gone, the real enemy we have to defeat is radical feminism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that some people have a benighted idea that feminism caused the decline in family values and so on. And to save civilization, they have to get rid of those of us who work for something like equal rights for women.
Mm-hmm. When I did a web search on your name, I found a huge number of links, and most of them, I would say, were in Italian, German, French. The ones in English were mostly from Britain. So you have had an enormous influence overseas since you emigrated, but your influence here has been more limited, it appears, or do you perceive it that way?
No, I agree totally. I think that there was an attempt, which was very effective, to silence my so-called voice in the United States, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that some of the people who were involved in that in the media were aware of what they were doing, and others just weren't.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it has anything to do with the sexual climate in Europe or the States? Or is it the scientific climate or the, just the journalistic mores?
I think there was more consolidation of media in this day, so it was easier for extremist groups to have their will done through the media in the States than it is in some other places where there's less centralization.
You have expressed some optimism about the way things have changed since the 60s, the 70s, greater amounts of attention to the female orgasm, and you attribute some of that to the feminist influence. Do you think that...
I would think all of it is attributable to the feminist influence, though, of course, there were some researchers every 20 years or so in the past in the United States before the women's movement, but really, I mean, in the, well, at the 1948 and 1952 were Kinsey publication dates, but Kinsey was very, very conservative in some ways. In terms of gay rights, he was very advanced, but in terms of women's rights, he wasn't advanced.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, there were Masters and Johnson, mm-hmm. who worked in the early 70s, late 60s, and they talked about female sexuality, and they brought up the word clitoris, which wasn't in general usage before that.
Mm.
Kinsey didn't use it.
Mm-hmm.
But they also said that they thought that women should get indirect stimulation during what they called thrusting of the clitoris, and yet they couldn't show how, and this was the Achilles heel of their treatment program.
Mm-hmm.
Then came my book in 1976, which showed that based on a large study of women in the United States, most women could orgasm easily during masturbation, and masturbation was exterior or clitoral. Therefore, that the definition of sex should change. Obviously, women can't change their bodies. Why should they want to?
One of the things that people have discussed about your work is the nature of your sampling method, and we'll talk about that in a second. But several random sample surveys of sexual behavior have been conducted in U.S., Britain, and France in the 90s, and they found very few differences between these three cultures, far fewer than the French, at least. You know, we've been led to believe that the French were much more sexually open. You have also done a cross-cultural comparison, and you found that British women were actually getting much better deal out of the sexual revolution than American or Australian or New Zealand women.
Well, of course, there was a difference in time period. But first of all, about the so-called sexual openness in Europe and
uh-huh.
so on.
Uh-huh.
Bear in mind that in England and in UK, for some time, I mean, abortion has always been accepted, whereas in the States, it's always been a big debating point.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't this possibility in the UK of saying that people are murderers because they have an abortion or because they perform an abortion and so on. So that right there is a big difference. Also, I'm a professor in Japan twice a year. And there, of course, abortion has been the main means of birth control for a very long time. Now the pill is becoming more popular, but also controversial.
So Japan may be more open in terms of having more sexuality in the media or more frank discussions of sexuality, but...
No, that's the country where you couldn't show a picture, including the pubic hair, including in pornography,
mm-hmm.
until last year.
Right.
So, I mean, there is no way to simply generalize about it all.
But,
there is a different climate in every country.
But do you think that there is a correlation between sexual openness and the position of women?
There's a big difference between the views of female sexuality in mm-hmm. lots of countries, but one should never overlook the fact that underneath it all, there's the second-class status of women.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the amount that women receive in terms of salary and their lack of promotion beyond the so-called glass ceiling, it's just about the same. When you said in your introduction that there was a correlation, obviously, if women felt free enough to use their bodies in the way that they wanted, orgasm wouldn't be a problem. That doesn't mean that women would have orgasm during coitus. Mm-hmm. My work has always tried to argue and research the fact that women have orgasm so easily during clitoral stimulation or exterior stimulation, but are expected by society and so on to have their orgasm like men do during coitus.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that external stimulation or orgasm during coitus has become more common since the 70s, since the new feminist movement?
I think maybe external stimulation has become slightly more common.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a massive expectation that women are going to have orgasm during coitus, and that if they don't, there's still a problem for women. You see that in Hollywood films, you see that in pornography, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
While many women understood, basically because of my work, and the influence of my work, which was repeated in many places, that they shouldn't consider that there's anything wrong with themselves, with them, if they don't have orgasm during coitus, I see the tide going backwards now.
One of the critiques of your work was on the basis of non-random nature of the surveys and low response rates. You've had 25 years of this methodological conversation. What are your current thoughts about the strengths and weaknesses of your casting these surveys out upon the waters and taking back the ones that you get?
Oh, I have so many thoughts on that. I wrote a 50-page essay in the Third Eye Report about it for those who really want to understand the details of it all.
Uh-huh.
I feel that most of the people who talk about my so-called methodology in the press haven't got a clue about methodology, but they like to use that as a kind of a general way to cover up what they'd really like to say, which is, wouldn't she like to shut up now, please? But, and also, women shouldn't be scientific, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big prejudice against women in science. However, I noticed that a couple of minutes ago you used the word, you referred to the so-called random surveys of a couple of people recently.
Okay, let's take a break from the interview, because this is just about where it started to go wrong. See, Ms. Height has always been very sensitive about this issue of randomness because, well, her sampling method has never been random, and random samples tell you very different things about sexuality than do non-random samples. Random samples tell you different things about everything. This is, for instance, what Tom Smith, the director of the General Social Survey, has to say in a paper called American Sexual Behavior, Trends, Sociodemographic Differences, and Risk Behavior, published in 1998, on the topic of extramarital relations. Quote, "There are probably more scientifically worthless facts on extramarital relations than on any other facet of human behavior. Popular magazines such as Red Book, Psychology Today, and Cosmopolitan, advice columnists such as Dr. Joyce Brothers, pop sexologists such as Morton Hunt and Sherry Height, have all conducted or reported on, quote, studies of extramarital relations. These studies typically find extremely high levels of extramarital activity. Height, for example, reported that 70% of women married 5 or more years are having sex outside of their marriage. They also often claim that extramarital relations have become much more common over time. Dr. Brothers, for example, claims that 50% of married women now have sex outside of marriage, double the level of a generation ago. But representative scientific surveys," of which he quotes several, "indicate that extramarital relations are less prevalent than pop and pseudoscientific accounts contend. The best estimates are that about 3-4% of currently married people have a sexual partner besides their spouse in a given year, and that about 15-17% of ever married people have had a sexual partner other than their spouse while married." Now, I actually worked on one of those studies when I was at Chicago, so I guess I have a bit of a vested interest, but I still felt that she had a lot of interesting things to say, and she was certainly an historical figure in feminist critique of American sexuality, and she has talked to literally tens of thousands of women about their sexual experience, and you do learn a lot from that. As she says, Freud based his theories on a survey of 3 upper-class Viennese women. So I was quite sure that she has had a lot of interesting things to say, and I wasn't going to press the issue of randomness too much. My opinion mirrored those of Julia Erickson, who recently wrote Kiss and Tell, Surveying Sex in the 20th Century. In an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education about her book, Ms. Erickson says, "I'm a friendly critic." In fact, she praises Kinsey and Sherheit, 2 path-breaking researchers criticized for questionable survey techniques. In his choice of topics and questions, she says, Kinsey created a field in a sense. And Ms. Height's popular and controversial books depict women as poorly served by their male partners. While acknowledging that Ms. Height's sampling methods are unrepresentative, Ms. Erickson praises her for challenging the idea underlying most surveys in the 1970s that with practice, women were on their way to becoming sexually fulfilled. So I thought in this interview, I'd give Ms. Hite a chance to rebut and defend herself a little bit. Okay, back to the interview.
So many surveys, so-called, that come out with findings which are not challenging anyone, and usually they're based on questions which in the beginning didn't challenge anyone, are referred to glibly as sort of random. Their scientific credentials are accepted as if there's no question, but the fact is that they're not very scientific. When you study something in the field of sexuality, random doesn't work, because though random sounds good, in fact, random was a concept that was invented for what's called hard science, that is, biology, geology, and so on. It doesn't work when you're trying to find out when people orgasm. Unless, of course, the people doing the random survey actually hooked the people up to electrodes and then watched if they did have an orgasm. But when you ask people if they have an orgasm, you can't do it by random sample, because in random sample, the people don't have anonymity. They may not, you may not tell their name to the public, i.e., our group interviewed so-and-so, but when you ask these people, did you or didn't you have an orgasm during coitus, then they know that you know their name and phone number and all these things. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's not a good way to get at the actual fact.
Mm-hmm. So you think that the honesty of the response is suspect?
One really funny study, which wasn't challenged by the media, asked whether or not people masturbated. Another one asked if they had extramarital affairs. So they did it by random marketing research. That is, you pick these people's names from the phone book randomly, mm-hmm. and then you call them up and ask them, oh, did you have an affair? Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine? You call up somebody who might be in the midst of having a family dinner, right. and you ask them this question, or cooking, or who knows? I mean,
they won't be very forthcoming.
No, because you might call the next day and speak to their spouse.
Mm-hmm. So have you responded to this methodological discussion by changing your methods at all? Have you made an effort?
Why should I respond to that method? I think they should change their methods.
Mm-hmm. But I mean,
my work predicted much more than anyone else's. I mean, my work has predicted very well.
Uh-huh.
And that, of course, is supposed to be the criterion in science. I would refer you to the article by The New Scientist about me that came out last year.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't want to beat this horse to death, but in reading one of these studies, the American study called The Social Organization of Sexuality, one of the things that
Is that the Chicago thing?
The Chicago study, yeah. They found
I don't respect the Chicago study very much, because I don't think their questions were very good.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at them, I could give you chapter and verse.
Mm-hmm.
But
one of the things that they found,
they don't allow, for example, to women to ask. They simply say things like, "Did you or didn't you have an orgasm during sex?" Mm-hmm. That's not an exact quote of their question, but this is the general gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if a woman wants to reply, that doesn't give a woman very much chance to choose a kind of response. What does it mean during sex?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I want to point out about that study is that they found that higher education was one of the predictors of people's likelihood of being sexually experimental and their likelihood of having orgasm during masturbation or during sex.
No, that's quite different, during masturbation and during sex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't put the two categories together, personally, if I were trying to discuss women. As society has known for generations that women had a so-called problem having orgasm during coitus, Kinsey made separate chapters. One was related to premarital sex and postmarital sex, because he tried to be positive and say that, well, women who'd been married longer were intending to have orgasm more frequently during that vague category sex. What my book did is to talk in more detail about when women had orgasm. I think it's an imperative to speak in detail if you're trying to talk about women. I think saying vague things like sexual experimentation, that's much too vague. What does that mean?
Well, one of the points I wanted to make about that is that if you just talk to people about their experiences, their subjective, subjectively, our sexuality seems very immutable and inevitable. But when you look cross culturally or across class or across race, and you see these kinds of variations, it suggests much more kind of...
Which kinds of variations? I've lost you.
Well, the higher education.
Well, I don't know what the percentage was and on which basis they found what. And what you've just said to me, it included sexual experimentation and orgasm during sex and masturbation. So that's a vast range of things, and if they lumped together that and then said that people who had higher education, by which percentage, I don't know. By higher education, they meant what? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even comment. I mean, I think they're so sloppy in their research.
Okay.
I really do.
I'm speaking to...
And exploitative as well. I mean, in the feminist movement in the 70s, we used to make fun of the male researchers who would run around attempting to study female sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And this is yet again, it looks like, you know, going back to the 50s.
In Sex and Business, you...
And the questions reflect that, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they should have taken advice, or they should have, you know, done half, had it half women and half men, and if they wanted to do something serious, or they should have looked into previous research like mine, where they got a better idea of what kind of questions women would respond to.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking today with Sherry Height. She's the author of The Height Report, The New Height Report, The Height Report on Height, and many other books about modern sexuality. In your most recent...
Well, there's The Height Report on Male Sexuality, The Height Report on Female Sexuality,
mm-hmm.
The Height Report on Women and Love, that's the emotions women have in
mm-hmm.
love affairs.
Mm-hmm. In your most recent book, Sex and Business, you ascribe bans on office romance to paternalistic bosses trying to be father to daughter's employees' sexuality.
50% of the population today is single. Therefore,
mm-hmm.
inside corporations, many, many people are single.
Mm-hmm.
To expect and to put a ban on them having relationships with other people at work, we're not talking about single people going out with married people. We're not talking about cases of sexual harassment. We're talking about single people at work who meet each other and like each other.
Mm-hmm.
To put a ban on saying on their having any kind of dating or relationship, I mean, that's simply unrealistic. So then I tried to explain that in those cases, one could even say it's like a father in a family saying, well, you can't have any sex in this house.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, there are other cases where sex is really inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the climate of sexual harassment law and policy has gone too far in big corporations, or is it at the appropriate place?
No, I think it's like the survey that we talked about a minute ago where there are four men conducting it. If you look at the heads of corporations, you find 99% of the Fortune 500, for example, headed by men, and they really need to... modernize their point of view and make it more specific. You can't just put a boilerplate rule on something and then expect that that solves everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what some corporations are trying to do is to avoid sexual harassment lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what they should be trying to do is to avoid sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm. So instead of banning romances in the workplace, you would be for... specific enforcement of any kind of violation of power relationships.
Yes, if that's possible. One thing I suggested in this book is to institute a new category of person inside corporations, and that would be a gender manager, someone that people could talk to about these issues.
Mm-hmm. In your research...
There also needs to be, inside many corporations, a kind of training course. And in the training course, well, they already have the training courses for managers, but they should institute some gender awareness in those courses.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of gender awareness do you think would benefit the modern workplace?
Well, what is sexual harassment? What kind of stereotypes do you have about the opposite sex? Should you have them? How can you readjust your mindset so that you think in a different way?
Mm-hmm. So you in your research in Sex and Business, you still perceive a great glass ceiling effect of gender...
I don't perceive it. It's statistically there.
Yes. And you ascribe it to gender stereotypes of male managers towards women workers.
I have to ascribe the what? The gender?
The fact that women aren't rising to the same levels within big corporations as men.
Do you ascribe it to women's lack of motivation?
Well, no, but I understand that, you know, some managers would ascribe it to women's wanting to have children or having different expectations about their careers.
Well, as I said to one of the CEOs of the Fortune 500s that I interviewed, if you think that you can't promote women who have children, then why don't you promote women who don't have children, such as many lesbians?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was met with total silence.
Right.
Obviously, lesbian women sometimes have children, but anyway, if lesbians are 10% of the population, and then there are another 10% of women who are married but don't have children and don't plan to, then those women could be promoted. However, I do feel that it's a smokescreen, the idea that, well, women have children and therefore you can't promote them. The few women who are at the tops of Fortune 500 companies and very successful do have children.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there are many female politicians, Margaret Thatcher, for example, who have children.
One of the topics that we often look at in this show is how technology changes human experience, and I'm wondering if you have given much thought to this. For instance, external stimulation during sex could involve sex toys, vibrators. Do you think that those have become more common in Western sex play?
I haven't asked people that.
You haven't looked at
it? I don't know.
Yeah. How about net porn? Do you think that there's a great discussion, at least in the American media, about the impact of net porn on families and our sexuality?
The main thing I would like to comment on at this moment is simply that it doesn't show clitoral stimulation to orgasm. It still shows coitus as a normal way to have sex. I don't find it progressive in any way.
Yeah.
It also contains side values of violence, aggression, so on. The point, which I think is getting lost in all of this, my work was dealing with women's right to their own body. Women have a way of having orgasm easily during masturbation.
Mm-hmm.
That way of having orgasm should be included in what we call sex. But what we call sex is a cultural institution, according to me,
mm-hmm.
and therefore it can change. However, it's been a kind of reproductive ritual rather than a real sexual interchange between people. This is what's wrong with it.
Well,
but the current surveys, promotions, marketing, and so on that you refer to, sex on video and in internet, seem to reinforce the old conceptions of what sex is, and I don't think those are even really particularly good for men.
I've been speaking with Sherry Haidt, the author of 10 books about sex, including Sex and Business and the original Haidt Report.
I really appreciate your coming on the show today.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.